morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Go out into the world and fight against poverty, racism, and militarism, Martin Luther King Jr. said 53 years ago at Riverside Church in New York City, April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. Americans have instead done just the opposite. Poverty is not only widespread, it is chronic. Not entirely an unplanned accident toward a two-tiered society of the extremely affluent and powerful, and everybody else struggling to survive at various fiscal levels from subsistence to insolvency. Racism is the pillar upon which the nouveau American aristocracy incites to grasp and graft power. And quasi-militaristic sedition gestalts its Weasley repression. Of course, none of this is unusual. The founders were very aware of this sort of imperious behavior, and after their own upheaval of it, promulgated the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to at least curtail the worst excesses of greed, inequality, and the grasping for absolute power over the people. The past 4 years have nearly reversed all that, although the threat has always been apparent and considerably nurtured before the ink on the Bill of Rights was dry. It has sort of happened as a confluence of undesirable outcomes. A corrupt, lying, bogusly elected president. He lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million, but rigged the Electoral College, whose seizure of power has influenced deceit, avarice, and corruption all through American society, and has been the major catastrophe that fulminated the sinister political plague that has abetted the microbiotic plague that is killing millions of humans worldwide, which includes 400,000 Americans, the worst yet to come in this still very young year. Politics is war without the killing, but not always. It is perpetual war, always in crisis, and about crises, real and imagined, which makes them real by the responses, yet alleviates most of the time the worst aspects of crises, which is war. Fortunately, Donald Trump has so far fumbled his attempt at destruction of American democracy, though it is seriously plagued. It will take a long time to repair the damages to democracy by Trump's willful seizure of quasi-dictatorial power. Yet everyone who cares about democratic governance should be aware of a chilling future without constitutional democracy, as imperfect and fragile though it is to zealotry, discrimination, corruption, and just plain venal stupidity. Too many of our companion citizens are susceptible to fraudulent snake oil remedies for political plagues. We Americans are truly our own worst enemies. Our nation and our beliefs are in constant turmoil, continually undermined by those among us who can credibly be considered treacherous. They are not the usual enemies we are assorted to hate. On the contrary, our real enemies are ever more likely to be our fellow citizens who are impatient with law or logic, suspicious of different races and ideas, and seem to prefer prejudice and violence to reason and tolerance. In the words of writer E. J. Dionne Jr., the process of intolerance is, quote, propaganda taken as fact, of slogans taken as arguments, of repetition substituted for logic, and of lies and half-truths taken as truth. And that was E.J. Dionne. Whatever greatness the USA has possessed, which has been our quest for liberty and justice for ordinary people of every race, creed, and affirmation, seems to be swiftly disintegrating through hatred and fear of those who feel threatened by consociation of thought, opinion, and persons. The immediate threat to democracy returning to the USA remains with former President Trump and his pathological refusal to acknowledge that a majority of American voters have replaced him. Trump's devilish co-conspirators pose a catch-22 to counter his second impeachment. He could not be tried for crimes while president because he was president, nor, they insist, can he be tried after his presidency because he is not president anymore. Governments use the good side of people to take power and control over them. Napa, Oregon resident and naturalized Vietnamese American Phuong Van Horn has said, "I am heartsick to see government use the good side of people to do evil for the power of government." And that was Phuong Van Horn. And now, by Frank Bruni, who will we be without Donald Trump? A friend was all worked up about the possibility of Trump 2024. "I can't go through this again," she cried. But what I heard was that she couldn't stop going through this. Her contempt for Donald Trump is too finely honed at this point, too essential a part of her psyche. Who would she be conversationally, politically, without it? Another friend sent me an email in which he had worked out the economics of a web-only Trump news channel of the kind that Trump may or may not start. With minimal investment, Trump could rake in millions and millions. We were supposed to be breathing a huge sigh of relief about Joe Biden's victory, but instead he was finding a fresh source of outrage about Trump. And here I am writing about Trump again. It's a tick, not one I'm proud of, but I'm surrendering to it now to acknowledge that I can't continue doing so. None of us can. I'm not talking just about journalists. An obsession with Trump as the root of all evil extends far beyond us. It has been an animating, organizing principle for the Democratic Party, a bond among civic-minded people of otherwise divergent persuasions, and a pillar of many Americans' political identity. It turned his rise and reign into an all-consuming international soap opera, with ratings not just through the roof, but also through the stratosphere. No public figure in my lifetime has made such a monopolizing claim on our attention, even our souls. But his presidency is over. His hold on us may not end as quickly and cleanly, however, and his departure from the White House is more disorienting than some of us realize, posing its own challenges. For Democrats, for news organizations, for anyone who has grown accustomed over these past 4 years to an apocalyptic churn of events and emotions. "Donald Trump is still coursing through your veins, isn't he?" asked John Harris in a column in Politico, likening him to an addiction from which there must be a meticulously plotted recovery. Actually, Democratic lawmakers seem to be moving on from him and revealing in the process what a potent glue he was. He united the party's left and center by giving them the same top priority. Dump Trump. No sooner was he dumped than the glue dissolved. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a New York progressive, and Connor Lamb, a Pennsylvania moderate, began trading recriminations about where Democrats went right, where they went wrong, and where they should go from here. So did Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Virginia moderate, and Rashida Tlaib, a Michigan progressive. The test for the mainstream media is our ability to turn away from Trump, even if he remains a potent audience draw. It's not certain that he will be. When Trump and Biden appeared at rival town halls on the same night in October, Biden drew more television viewers, and the much-discussed Trump bump that cable news channels and newspapers experienced in and right after 2016 faded over time. But there's no doubt that chronicling and commenting on how bad Trump is for democracy has been good for business. It also made virtuous sense. His station and power justified coverage of every tweet and bleep. His attempt to steal the election demands exactly the scrutiny it is getting, as does the assent of his base and most of his fellow Republicans. The situation, however, will soon grow complicated. Unlike his more dignified predecessors, he won't maintain a relatively low post-presidency profile. He'll keep whipping up passions on the right, and there will surely be a laudable journalistic excavation of Trump administration misdeeds that he and his aides successfully buried. Suffice it to say that Trump will not exit the news. I also worry that in the wake of Trump's presidency, which both reflected and intensified the furious pitch of American politics, melodrama may be the new normal. I worry that while Americans are exhausted by it, we're also habituated to it, that we will manufacture it where it doesn't exist, that hearings in a Republican-controlled Senate will turn Hunter Biden into the new Benghazi, and that we'll hear no less from the likes of Lindsey Graham and Rudy Giuliani, because no reality show would cast off cast members that juicy. I worry that my worry is part of the problem, that it's not so much epiphany as muscle memory. It has gotten a hell of a workout since 2016. And that was Frank Bruni. Who will we be without Donald Trump? And he wrote it for the New York Times. And also for the New York Times, an article by Timothy Egan. After 5 centuries, a Native American with real power. In the American West, a ration of reverence is usually given to the grizzled Anglo rancher who rises at a public hearing and announces that his people have been on the land for 5 generations. So what are we to make of Representative Deb Haaland, a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo, who says that her people have been in the Rio Grande Valley of New Mexico for 35 generations, dating to the 13th century. Native history is American history, she told me. Regardless of where you are in this country now, you are on ancestral Indian land, and that land has a history. As Joe Biden's choice for Interior Secretary, Ms. Haaland is poised to make a rare positive mark in the history of how a nation of immigrants treated the country's original inhabitants. She is the first Native American cabinet secretary, a distinction that has prompted celebration throughout Indian country. I haven't been the one making policy, she said, but I've been the one on the receiving end of it. There will be plenty of sniping, second-guessing, and disappointment among the tribes by people who expect much of Haaland having a seat at the big table. But for now, we should let this moment breathe. I spoke to her on the anniversary of a day of infamy. On December 29, 1890, the U.S. Army slaughtered men, women, and children at Wounded Knee in South Dakota. Government policy was to strip Indians of their language, culture, and religion, with children sent off to boarding schools where they were taught that the old ways were wrong. At the end of the 19th century, the popular view was that indigenous people would soon disappear. And yet, here is Haaland, one of more than 5 million Native Americans, ready to knock down some of the last barriers of time and terrain in this country. Her personal story alone makes her an anomaly in the parlors of power. Soon after graduating from college, she became a single mother. She was sometimes dependent on food stamps, and she once ran a small business selling homemade salsa to make a living and support her child. As a freshman representative in 2019, she was still paying off her student loans. When she ran for office, her slogan was, "Congress has never heard a voice like mine." Now the person with that voice will be overseeing one-fifth of the land in the United States. As Interior Secretary, her portfolio includes national parks, wildlife refuges, the United States Geological Survey, and the vast acreage of the Bureau of Land Management. Interior, for good reason, is known as the Department of Everything Else. As such, she will also be overseeing millions of acres taken from Indians in treaties broken over the past several centuries. She is the top government liaison with 574 federally recognized tribes, the nations within a nation. This is quite the compass. From a deep slot in the earth near the Grand Canyon, wherein dwell the Havasupai, to the rainforest of the Olympic Peninsula, home of the Maka Nation, to urban neighborhoods that house Indians struggling with health care access. "I wish we could right some wrongs," she said of the centuries-old saga. But she seems content to try to right the many wrongs that Donald Trump's administration has inflicted on the land. Trump's first Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, literally rode into office on a horse named Tonto and then promptly launched a campaign to make it easier to drill on public land. The most recent secretary, David I. Bernhardt, was an oil and gas lobbyist whose public service on behalf of his former clients was warmly received by his old friends. Biden has pledged to end all new oil and gas drilling on these rangelands, forests, and plains, an enormous change that will be fought fiercely by those who profit from land owned by all Americans. He has also promised to restore Bears Ears National Monument, a marvel of sandstone mountains and native sacred sites in the Southwest that was gutted by Trump, who reduced the size of the protected area by 85%. Haha Land is eager for the opportunity to do something lasting. "I will be fierce for all of us, for our planet, and all of our protected land," she said in December. But it's the weight of Native history that makes the choice of Haha Land so extraordinary. As she acknowledged, "This movement is profound when we consider the fact that a former Secretary of the Interior once proclaimed it his goal to, quote, civilize or exterminate us." She was referring to Alexander H. Stewart, the Secretary of the Interior in the early 1850s in the Fillmore administration. Exterminate was no exaggeration. The census of 1900 counted over 270,000 Native Americans, a population collapse of nearly 90%. In the estimate of many ethnohistorians from the time of first European contact. Some of the atrocities are well known, but less well known is the government made it a crime for natives to practice their religion. It was a violation of the First Amendment to lock people up for enacting the rituals of faith unless they worshiped native gods through certain dances and ceremonies deemed criminal by the government. A consistent plea from Indian country today is a request that fellow Americans consider Native people as much more than living relics locked in a tragic past. Haha Land aims to ensure that "I'll never forget where I came from," she said. But she added, "I love this opportunity." Even if she can't reverse history, she is poised to make some. And that was After 5 Centuries, A Native American with Real Power by Timothy Egan, who is a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times and covers the environment, the American West, and politics. And he's a winner of the National Book Award and author most recently of A Pilgrimage to Eternity. and now. John Forbes Kerry, former U.S. Senator and Secretary of State under Barack Obama, has been named as American Climate Envoy by President Joe Biden. His job as official climate Cassandra at large is to reattach the USA to the world's environmental system and help shoulder the rigorous challenge of piloting recalcitrant humanity through shoals of impending ecocide and help prevent its kamikaze plunge to extinction. Kerry started public life as a leading member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. In the early 1970s, as senator, he joined fellow senator and Vietnam POW John McCain in advocating for post-war reconciliation with Vietnam. In 2004, Kerry campaigned for the presidency against incumbent George W. Bush, which he lost in large measure as a result of a vicious smear campaign that tarnished his war record, conducted by alleged veterans who publicly denounced him as a traitor for his involvement with Vietnam Veterans Against the War. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, an Oregon native from Yamhill, investigated the derogatory accusations against Kerry that year. This is what he wrote. A War Hero or a Phony, by Nicholas Kristof, published in the New York Times in 2004. So is John Kerry a war hero or a medal-grabbing phony? Each time that I have written about President Bush's dalliance with the National Guard, conservative readers have urged me to scrutinize the accusations against Mr. Kerry. After doing so over the last week, here's where I come out. Did Mr. Kerry volunteer for dangerous duty? Not as much as his campaign would like you to believe. The Kerry website declares, as he was graduating from Yale, John Kerry volunteered to serve in Vietnam because, as he later said, it was the right thing to do. In fact, as Mr. Kerry was about to graduate from Yale, he was inquiring about getting an educational deferment to study in Europe. When that got nowhere, he volunteered for the Navy, which was much less likely to involve danger in Vietnam than other services. After a year on a ship in the ocean, Mr. Kerry volunteered for swift boats, but at that time they were used only in Vietnam's coastal waters. A short time later, the swift boats were assigned exceptionally dangerous duties up Vietnamese rivers. When I signed up for the swift boats, they had very little to do with the war, Mr. Kerry wrote in 1986, adding, I didn't really want to get involved in the war. Did Mr. Kerry get his first Purple Heart for self-inflicted wound? That's the accusation of the swift boat Veterans for Truth, who say that the injury came unintentionally from a grenade that Mr. Kerry fired at Viet Cong. In fact, nobody knows where the shrapnel came from, and it's possible that the critics are right. It's not certain that the Viet Cong were returning fire, but the only other American on the boat in a position to see anything, Bill Zaldonis, who says he voted for Mr. Bush in 2000, told me he was hurt, and I don't think it was self-inflicted. Did Mr. Kerry deserve his second and third Purple Hearts? There's not much dispute that the second was merited. As for the third one, the swift boat veterans claim he received it for a minor injury he got while blowing up food supplies to keep them from the enemy. But documents and witness accounts show that he received a shrapnel wound when South Vietnamese troops blew up rice stores and an injured arm in a mine explosion later that day. Did Mr. Kerry deserve his Bronze Star? Yes. The swift boat veterans claimed that he was not facing enemy fire when he rescued a Green Beret, Jim Rassman, but that is contradicted by those who were there, like William Root and Mr. Rassman, a Republican. In fact, Mr. Rassman recommended Mr. Kerry for a Silver Star. Did Mr. Kerry deserve his Silver Star? Absolutely. He earned it for responding to two separate ambushes in a courageous and unorthodox way by heading straight into the gunfire. Then he pursued one armed fighter in the jungle and shot him dead. According to Fred Short, a machine gunner who saw the event, the fighter was an adult, not the half-naked teenager sighted by the Swift Boat veterans, who was preparing to launch a grenade at the boat. "Carey went into harm's way to save the lives of the guys on the boat," Mr. Shore told me. "If he hadn't have done that, I'm absolutely positive I would not be here today." Mr. Carey's commander said he had wanted to give him an even higher honor, the Navy Cross, but thought it would take too long to process. Did Mr. Carey exaggerate his exploits? Yes. For example, he has often said over the years that he spent Christmas 1968 in Cambodia as part of the secret war there. Others who served with him confirmed that on Christmas Eve 1968, not Christmas Day, he got very close to the border and possibly even straight across it. But it doesn't seem to have been, as Mr. Carey has suggested, a deliberate incursion into Cambodia. What do those who served with him say? Some who served on other boats have called Mr. Carey a hypochondriac self-promoter. But every enlisted man who was with Mr. Carey on various boats when he won Purple Hearts and Silver and Bronze Stars says he deserved them. All praise his courage and back his candidacy for presidency. I was there for two of the Purple Hearts and the Bronze and Silver Stars, and he earned every one of them, said Delbert Sandusky in a typical comment. He saved our lives. The bottom line, Mr. Carey has stretched the truth here and there, but earned his decorations, and the Swift Boat veterans, contradicted by official records, and virtually everyone who witnessed the incidents, are engaging in one of the ugliest smears in modern U.S. politics. This is Michael McCusker. Engineer for this program is Dylan Hauser-Schulp. The bifurcated history of human civilization is divided into D.C. and A.D., or the more modern equivalent, B.C.E. and C.E., before the Common Era and Common Era. We now have a more microscopic measure of contemporary time, B.T. and A.T., before Trump and most recently after Trump. The four-year span of his chaotically repulsive presidency, which seemed at least four millennia, might be calculated as during Trump, or DT, and it certainly has resembled the DT's delirium tremens in psychoanalytic parlance. This current pandemic era has yet to run its deadly course. The USA alone is reaching toward 500,000 rate of corona deaths. Continue to mask up and lock down for self and selfless preservation. Vaccines are on the way, but need is greater than supply. So remember the golden rule. Protecting yourself protects everybody else.